The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, tonight we're on God's Man of Faith versus the American Confidence Man. I'd like to begin by reading a passage of Scripture to you from 1 Samuel 4. Later on, we're going to be talking about Jeremiah 17, but at the beginning here, we want to come to 1 Samuel 4, and I want to show you something about faith and presumption. We'll begin to read with verse 1 of 1 Samuel 4. Thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer, while the Philistines camped in Aphek. And the Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who sits above the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And it happened, as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, that all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Therefore be men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. And the slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. And the Ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Now, there's a great deal more to that story, which you are welcome to read on your own. But I'd just like to begin by challenging you to think about this story from the point of view of faith. And when you begin to think about the Israelites here, What is it? Do they have faith or do they not? Now, doesn't faith consist in great part in confidence? It does, doesn't it? Faith, in large part, is confidence. We speak of trust as, you know, the center of faith. And here they certainly had plenty of confidence. What went wrong then? Anyone want to venture a response to that? Why did they get so fouled up? Tom?
Well, their faith was in the wrong thing.
All right, they had a great deal of confidence, but their faith was in the wrong thing. Can you explain that? All right, they were carrying around this object. They were putting their trust in the ark apart from the Lord. Was there anything else that might have confirmed them in the feeling that that was right? Who told them that this was the thing to do? Was it just anybody that said that they better get the ark, or was it somebody? The elders. So some who understood about things, the older men, the wise ones. They said, a question comes up. They have the right idea that it was the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines. They couldn't think of a battle as being chance. So their theology was basically sound, at least up to a point. And so they said, the Lord has defeated us today. Why? Well, the answer must be that we didn't do things quite the right way. Therefore, to make the correction, take with you the Ark of the Covenant. And so they take with them the Ark of the Covenant, and what happens? Before they lost 4,000 men, and now what happens? Now they lose 30,000. That must have been a shocker indeed. And you, as you see things follow, the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, they died. And then when the report comes to Eli, you go down verse 12, 13, 14, and he hears the report. And he asked him, verse 16, how did things go, my son? And when he hears the report, verse 18, he falls off the seat backward beside the gate, and his neck is broken, and he died. And so the difficult thing in experience, in history, in society then, is to distinguish between that which is faith, from that which is an unholy presuming. The feeling that because we have been blessed in the past, or we have a heritage, therefore God is bound to bless us in the future. Many a man has had deep agony in his soul because he could not understand the ways of God, but if he'd read this passage, he would immediately have had the key to unlock the story of his life. Because sooner or later, I think we all pass this way. In fact, maybe we do it sooner or later. We probably do it all the time. How about that for a pessimistic thought for the evening? Well, no, that's not a pessimistic thought for the evening, because once you discover you're doing that, you can repent of it and get out of it. There's no value in going around carrying your ark, getting slaughtered all the time. It'd be much better to drop a few of the things you're doing, including your presumption, and be liberated. Now, let's turn a little bit, a few years later, maybe a generation later, where they begin to get the message. The ark goes into captivity, the Lord vindicates his name, and the Dagon falls down before the ark of the God of the Covenant, and they finally end up, the Philistines, sending that ark back. Well, then when we get to chapter 7, after this history unfolds, they really do learn something from their own history. And I think this is impressive. When you come here, they are again having war with the Philistines. And this time, though, they have a new leader. God has raised up Samuel. And Samuel gives them directions on how to get right with God so they're not presuming. If you return to the Lord with all your heart, this is verse 3 of chapter 7, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, and he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. And they did it. So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and Ashtaroth and served the Lord alone. Then Samuel said, verse 5, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. And they gathered together at Mizpah. They drew water and poured it before the Lord, fasted, and they confessed their sin. We have sinned against the Lord, they said. And so when they went into battle, they had confessed their sins, they'd humbled themselves, they'd put away their idols. And then to show you how little confidence they have in themselves, in verse 8, they cry out to Samuel, do not cease to cry to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines. And this time they went out and they really whopped the Philistines. And you say, man, the Bible makes things way too simple. You know? It says you do it right, you win. You do it wrong, you lose. Well, yeah, that's the way the Bible is. that's the way faith is, too. And so the point you would get here is in chapter 7, we see faith in operation, and it's much different from what looks like the same thing. And what's the difference? Now, you can see certain effects of the faith. They turn away from idols. They serve the Lord and so on. But what's the difference? Before, they lacked what? Which was in faith. Well, they had confidence But they have, I think probably by the time they're through, they have confidence again. But what's the borderline? The word I'm thinking of is obedience, but it's of a certain kind that got them there, humility. You see, there is that in faith which is a recognition of your own emptiness. And the confidence is placed in that which is outside of you, not that which is inside of you. And when we speak of faith that justifies, we say that we look away from every good thing in us or anyone else to Jesus alone, right? We even look away from our sins. And that's why we say that we're justified by faith alone. It's not that faith is alone without works attending it, but rather it's by trust in Jesus alone that we are justified. On that basis, God pardons us because Jesus' righteousness is reckoned to our account. And so faith then has that quality of confidence, but away from ourselves to God in His Christ. Now, you say that neatly and simply, but that's where it all is. And that's what affects life, and that's what affects culture and everything else. So you might say then that both presumption and faith have a boldness about them. And that's why they're often hard to tell apart. And you see oftentimes our faith gets a mixture. It's a mixture of believing and presuming. And for a long time, we think, boy, are we children of faith. The Lord hears all my prayers. And then one day you wake up and your faith isn't strong anymore. Well, it isn't any weaker than it ever was. It's just that through a little experience, God has burned out a little more of the presumption. And now you realize there wasn't all as much faith as you thought. And now's a chance for God to teach you how to grow some more. So you can't lose. See, whichever way you go, you always win. You're a born winner if you're a Christian. And even when you think you're losing, you're winning. You see, we ended up on a very happy note. So next time you find yourself flat on your back, remember you're looking up, right? Okay, we've had our quotable quote for tonight. Let's begin now by seeing a little bit of how this is found in American literature. And I'd like to begin with Jonathan Edwards' personal narrative tonight. And it's really a beautiful document. I suppose this is his journal. Now, we don't ask you to write a journal like this, but keep jotting down. And if you get a few good thoughts, praise the Lord, because he had a few here. And he's telling about here how he did not like the divine sovereignty. If there's one thing he disliked when he was young, it was God's sovereignty, and it just was unbearable. But then something happened. He got converted. And apparently, of all things, through 1 Timothy 1:17, "Now unto the King, eternal, immortal, invisible, to the only wise God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen." And you see, he couldn't even sing it, and he still got converted by it. And here's what he says. "There has been a wonderful alteration in my mind with respect to the doctrine of God's sovereignty from that day to this, so that I scarce ever have found so much as the rising of an objection against it in the most absolute sense, in God showing mercy to whom he will show mercy, and hardening whom he will. God's absolute sovereignty and justice with respect to salvation and damnation is what my mind seems to rest assured of as much as of anything that I see with my eyes. At least it is so at times. But I have often, since that first conviction, had quite another kind of sense of God's sovereignty than I had then. And I have often since had not only a conviction, but a delightful conviction. The doctrine has very often appeared exceeding pleasant, bright, and sweet." Now, if you remember our friend, the other Puritan we read, the one who's made light to compare Jesus to heaven's sugar cake, you'll find you're a little bit back to the same vocabulary. The Puritans always, you know, they don't use the word sweet quite in our sense. A little bit different flavor to it. That was a bad one. I withdraw that one. Absolute sovereignty is what I love to ascribe to God, but my first conviction was not so. The first instance that I remember of that sort of inward sweet delight in God and divine things that I have lived much in since was on reading those words, 1 Timothy 1:17. Now unto the King, eternal, immortal, invisible, to the only wise God be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen. He read those words, and he was turned around. The Spirit darted a ray of light into his heart, and he had a sense of the glory of the divine being. And from that point on, Edwards was on a glory road. Now, this affected his life. Now, this is what I want to try to direct this a bit towards your journal. I want you to I sure wish that you would consider the possibility that the world might be brighter than you know, and that you might begin to record that fact. First of all, with your eyes and in your heart, and then writing it down so you can remember it. Now, how this came across to Edwards was this. After he got this sweet burning in his heart as he beheld God in his glory, this awful sweetness, a high and great and holy gentleness, all of this entered into him, he began to notice the natural world. After this, my sense of divine things gradually increased and became more and more lively and had more of that inward sweetness. The appearance of everything was altered. There seemed to be, as it were, a calm, sweet cast or appearance of divine glory in almost everything. God's excellency, his wisdom, his purity and love seemed to appear in everything. In the sun, moon, and stars, in the clouds and blue sky, in the grass, flowers, trees, in the water and all nature, which used greatly to fix my mind. I often used to sit and view the moon for continuance, and in the day spent much time in viewing the clouds and sky to behold the sweet glory of God in these things. And you see, when you're writing a journal, you run out of vocabulary and you keep using one word that sticks with you, and that's one he does use. So he says, I see that sweet glory of God in all these things. In the meantime, and while he did this, singing forth with a low voice my contemplations of the Creator and Redeemer. In other words, he both viewed it, and he sang about it, and he wrote it down. And then he said, and scarce anything among all the works of nature was so sweet to me as thunder and lightning. Formerly, nothing had been so terrible to me. Before, I used to be uncommonly terrified with thunder and to be struck with terror when I saw a thunderstorm rising and used to take the opportunity at such times to... Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped down here. And to be struck with terror when I saw a thunderstorm arising, but now on the contrary, it rejoiced me. I felt God, so to speak, at the first appearance of a thunderstorm, and used to take the opportunity at such times to fix myself in order to view the clouds and see the lightnings play and to hear the majestic and awful voice of God's thunder, which oftentimes was exceedingly entertaining, leading me to sweet contemplations of my great and glorious God. While thus engaged, it always seemed natural to me to sing or chant for my meditations or to speak my thoughts and soliloquies with a singing voice. Now, isn't that interesting? Did you ever have a picture of a Calvinist like that before? You know, the average person who has a picture of the Calvinist, I remember in college I had this, it was either literature or comp class, and they had to write an assignment on a thing I'd worked out, which is kind of tricky to do, and this one girl was searching for a way to show that her character she was describing had burning eyes. And so she said, His eyes were flashing with the fire of a Calvinist, you know. And you could just see the baleful lights coming out, you know. this is a public image of the Puritan as though someone who's secretly afraid that there's someone happy somewhere. Well, this is not what you get here. You get a completely different picture. Isn't that true? Your own main problem would be, is that possible for me? Is that real? Could anyone be that happy and in this world? And the challenge is kind of there before you, isn't it? Now, it's surprising. If you read the early Puritan literature, now they're not all a lie. You've got old Samuel Sewall keeping his diary, boring me to death as I read it, because he loves to count up all the material things that he, you know. But the, and then you have a totally different mind in John Winthrop and his journal. You have, again, a totally different kind of mind in William Bradford, History of Plymouth Plantation. But you have one thing about them all, that they're very sure of themselves in relationship to God. And there's a spirit of freedom and boldness. You know, you just don't walk out and look at a thunderstorm from a prominent place unless you're pretty sure of where you are in relationship to God. So it really is an example of the priesthood of believers, isn't it? That the idea that you are near to God through Jesus Christ, the mediator. So that goes deep into the American experience. I want to use just one more illustration to show you how this works out. When you pick up Of Plymouth Plantation by William Bradford and you read it, you'll find he's weighing with the others whether they should come to the New World, and the matters are being gone pro and con, and almost everything is measured out there from the area of religious freedom to economics. And it's not just a single picture. But one thing that strikes me is this, that once they decide it's God's will they come, that there's no consideration of the possibility of failure. Now, if you can for a moment in your mind's eye project yourself back there, imagine this little ship arriving at Plymouth Rock, and a lot of these people are going to die 4 years over, 1620, and you know, before them is a vast, vast forest. There are enough Indians around. They don't know, you see, that the influenza has wiped out a lot of the Indians. They have no way of knowing that. But ordinarily, there have been enough Indians around that will wipe them out very quickly. So there's the Indians, the forest, and then the whole matter of a different climate, and on and on and on. And it could have been just a terrifying thing. If you just sat down and counted up the adversaries and the dangers and the probabilities, you'd have died on the spot. And it may well be that that's what happened to William Bradford's wife, because there's just a little terse note that his wife was lost overboard in the harbor. Now, she may, there's speculation, have committed suicide when she saw what was in front of her. I don't know that. That might be dangerous speculation, but I think it was an awesome thing to land on those shores. And it was either presumption or faith. And because they had faith, it was very bold, incredible. So this high adventure, which began in this country, was rooted really in faith. So what I want to get across to you then is that here we have God's man of faith coming on a spiritual adventure. And I'd also like to show you that the American confidence man is a kind of a secularization of this. That's basically what we're after tonight. So you get the statement. So write down in those notes that sentence. I want that down there. That the confidence man, the American confidence man, is a kind of a secularization of the Puritan man of faith, or the Christian man of faith. We'll also find these many other things. He's kind of a reversal, because what was believing turns into presuming, and that fits in with the passage of Scripture we have read. Now, there are certain things I want you to help me to find in the American experience that contributed to this secularization process, and we'll see how it's brought about conflict in American life. But let's ask ourselves something I think we did a little bit one evening. What are some things that have happened here that have not happened in the U.S. that almost regularly happen in other countries? What are some things that do not or have not happened here very much, or at least until recently, that have happened all the time in other countries? Now, let's just take any country at random that we might want to compare ourselves with. Say, France.
War.
All right, war. Now, we've had a few wars, but none of them ended up with our being what? Loser. But not only that, countries win wars, but what can happen by the time you've won the war? You have been... Yeah, you've been wiped out. You've been invaded. And they wonder when they win the war who really won the war, because the losses are so high. You know, it's said of Napoleon that he shortened the height of the average Frenchman 1 inch. Now, I don't know whether I want to prove that. I don't know why. But he took so many of them into battle, and there were so many of the taller ones that were volunteered. Well, he had a draft, I think, too. But so many of the taller ones were killed that the national height of the Frenchman dropped an inch after Napoleon. Now, I can't even remember where I got that statistic, but it was somewhere back in some musty volume, I suppose. But be that as it may, now look at France. Just, if you don't go back to Napoleon, let's take what wars has France been involved with since, say, the last century, the late in the last century? Well, you know of two in this century, okay? World War I and World War II. Terrible experience, right? And then before that was the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. They lost that one. The Prussians really wiped them out. Yeah, let's hold back on Vietnam. We're going to come to Vietnam in just a minute. That's for us. Right. It was just one side or the other. And you can imagine then the experience of that kind of thing, you know, invasion, counter-invasion, wars won, wars lost, and so on. That's a pretty rough way to be treated. Now, you can never remember our having been invaded by the Canadians or our having been invaded by the Mexicans, except as farm workers. It just has happened. There have been a few invasions around, but it's been our invasions of them rather than the reverse. So you see, we have... I think that's a factor in the turning, in the secularizing of faith. That we didn't have so much of the loss of the Ark of the Covenant. We continued to win, maybe too much for our own good. All right, then let's take the matter of disease. And, of course, malnutrition and all the rest that goes with it. Did you know that even from the very beginning that the reason the population in the United States grew so fast wasn't that we just had more babies over here in the colonies, though it was said in places in Europe that did not like the English Puritans here in America that they multiply like rabbits. That was really not the case. The studies of village growth, population growth in New England compared to villages in France show that the birth rate was the same. The difference lay in the survival rate. Here in America, we were lucky, right? No, God had blessed these people with habits of hygiene and care of nutrition and things like that. And They had faith, and I do believe that faith makes people take better care of themselves and gives them peace of mind. They tend to survive diseases better. Now, I don't want to make that at one-to-one, but I think it's been striking that perhaps part of it was the isolation over here. But nonetheless, there was a lot more disease sweeping French villages and carrying off the population. You know, as much as a third of the population in a village could go in a very short time with disease. Now, you get the same thing today in Bangladesh and India, cholera and things like that. Yellow fever. Now, in the U.S., I don't have a medical history of the United States, and I only got kind of thinking about this recently, but it seems to me, in the best recollection I have of epidemics in this country, there are only two that stand out in my mind. Now, I'm only 200 years old, so you see, I may not know all of that. But maybe you know about others. I only know of there was some epidemics in the 18th century. I think there was one in here, right through this area, around the 1790s, wasn't there? Pardon? I don't know what it was, but there was some kind of plague that came through this area. A good deal of sickness. But then the next time that I think of any widespread disease is either what the Indians got or what hit in 1918 and 1919, when about 2 million, I guess, Americans were carried off. It's interesting, history books don't play up this kind of thing, do they? But that's, with the swine flu coming on, it makes you think, doesn't it, you see? And I don't know whether it's coming on or not. But my point is, we have been relatively immune from what a lot of people have been exposed to. And so that today, there are plenty of Americans who have never been what? Far as death is concerned. They've never been exposed to it. They've never even been to a funeral. Some of them just avoided that much. You see, many parents don't take children to funerals. And in times past, you all got involved maybe in the wake or something else, you know, and you got sort of super exposed to the whole business. And so what I'm saying is almost that there's a insulating from the world as it flows on that Americans have experienced. All right, now what about our rulers? We really blasted ex-President Nixon the other night. I thought I hit him a little harder than I even intended to. But the thing is, having said that, if you compared ex-President Nixon with some of the other rulers of the world, how would he come off, even with those today? And often so, because the men were tyrants, and one tyrant threw out another. Someone has said this of Spain, that Spain could never be a democracy because it has 30 million kings. Now, I don't know whether that was Ortega y Gasset. I think that was who.
Governed both in any history.
Pardon me?
Spain had the longest government in the history outside of Victoria, the recent Franco regime.
In Franco regime, yes, I think that's true. And that's why they said they needed Franco. 30 million kings need Franco. But you see, the point I want to make is we've never had an Ivan the Terrible. You know, even in English history, you have to go back a ways to find somebody really bad. The English and American history sort of flow together. And, George III wasn't all that, you know, he hardly didn't have it all together. And his ministers at that time didn't either. But Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, Napoleon, Hitler, Frederick the Great. And you could go over history and you could... You know, well, many of the world rulers are really shocked that Nixon was put out of office on the grounds that he was, because in most parts of the world, you know, things are so much worse. So much worse. And I don't need to regale you with stories of how bad they are. They are, just take my word for it. Many of the world rulers are really shocked that Nixon was put out of office on the grounds that he was, because in most parts of the world, you know, things are so much worse. So much worse. And I don't need to regale you with stories of how bad they are. They are, just take my word for it. The human history, it reveals that Lord Acton was right. Absolute power, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And a lot of people who had it really were corrupted. So we have been really blessed by not having experienced tyranny in rulers in a large scale. Now part of it, well, one more thing I want to mention. We've also not had a national religion which has been the basis for imposing tyranny. That's another thing we've never had in this country. There may have been a bit of that in the beginning, say in Virginia, where it was pretty rough to be a Presbyterian when it was all Episcopalian government, but that only caused, it was pretty mild persecution, that only caused the Presbyterian movement to flourish. It wasn't any hard-nosed stuff like you got, say, in 17th century France, or even 18th century France. And then other things you could add, let's make this in the positive side now. Really good things about our land, not just these things that didn't happen to us. One is the sheer abundance of land here. And the land in this country is great stuff. Russian crops are failing often for two reasons. One is climate, but the other is the land. The land is not nearly as good as it is in this United States. I've seen land in the United States so rich, you know, is, what did one of the poets say, that if you put a fork in it, it would spurt? You know, it's just the... Just amazing. Where we lived in the San Joaquin Valley, west there of Stockton, you had those islands that peat dust. Why, most productive area in the world. No place in the world grows like that. Just a little bit south of there, you had that heavy clay loam, and you have to have a special tractor to move through it, and that grows another kind of thing. A little bit further on down, you have that white sand, and the Iowa farmer knows that won't grow anything. But to his astonishment, it grows corn taller than in Iowa. So it's a rich country wherever you are. And, of course, not to say anything about Iowa, which is famous for many good things, as well as Wisconsin and other places which some of you may come. But the point I want to make is that this is a land of great wealth. Just in the farming opportunities have here been enormous. And that has affected the country in a number of ways. One, it's made jobs more plentiful. That if you didn't like it in the factory here in the east, you could head west. And that put a certain pressure on the employers to keep wages reasonably high in order to hold the workers. And then there was an upward mobility made available through free education. Coming out of the common school of here the East Coast, there was this matter of education, at least up to a number of grades, and eventually going much further. And then another thing that is very striking here in this land is free trade. We don't have tariffs between Pennsylvania and, say, Delaware or New York or New Jersey. It's free trade. It's an island of with a large island with this freedom to pass commodities back and forth for sale without paying taxes on them. And then with it is the stable government that is unfolded. Now, as Ken Wallace was mentioning, here we have government that's gone on for two centuries, and behind it was the equally stable colonial government for usually another 100 years. Now, the world just isn't used to this kind of thing. We take so much for granted. Now, it wasn't always in the Western world there was stable government. Our ancestors were pretty tough characters, and we might want to sneer at the blacks in Africa, but you go back to about the 5th century... A.D. The 5th century A.D., 6th century. And man, those German tribes there, France, you know, even when they began to become Christians, they chopped the enemy's head off, and they hollowed it out, and polished it up, and worked it up a little bit, and stopped up the holes, and that was your drinking mug. Yeah. They were rough characters. I don't even know anybody in Africa that does that. You know, I won't regale you with any more stories. I think you had enough. But they did an awful lot of poisoning of one another. Stabbing. And they were pretty primitive. So what we got to realize in stable government, the respect for law, all of these things are most remarkable here. And then other things that happened, we saw victories in every area. One was the commerce, the spreading of the railroad, the opening of canals before that, the opening of communication, telegraph, telephone. All of these things made Americans success-oriented. Cheap goods, quickly transported. And behind it, other blessings that people really took for granted. For example, one of the things I believe I referred to earlier, a distinctive feature of American life, is respect for written law. American constitutionalism differs from British constitutionalism on this point. The Americans are covenant-oriented. They like to write it down. And it comes out of they're reading the Bible. You can see it in New England. They're making covenants underneath the coverage of the covenant of grace. So this whole idea of respect for contract, which really meant a way of sealing your word in writing, abiding by it. Well, no wonder then that what we saw is that Americans could write the unique fantasy, the thing like, not Alice in Wonderland, but Dorothy in the Land of Oz, the Wizard of Oz. And so what really happened in the secularizing process that went along with this, that a reversal came about in which this became a basic American attitude. And that attitude is that the universe is friendly. Once we kill the Indians and so on, the universe is friendly. Right? That's American. The universe is friendly. It's an American world. Now, that may have taken the form, a crude form, in the 19th century. Instead of providence, they began to talk about manifest destiny. It being manifest destiny that the United States government was going to exercise authority from the North Pole to Columbia. But this was the more generalized expression of it. The universe is friendly. And in the story then of Dorothy, everything at bottom is friendly. It's only the appearance of it that is harsh or threatening or evil. Penetrate through it and you can see it's an American universe. That universe is a friendly place. And what all you need then, and a second principle, all you need for success is to get organized. There's nothing you cannot do. The question isn't whether we can do it. The only question is how long will it take? And wars come, and there was that nasty business of the Civil War, and revival came out of that. But still, the great movement was in the direction of thinking that Americans could increasingly function on their own. And God's relationship to the whole thing was to guarantee that the universe was friendly. And to guarantee that we might get the best organization of the best people. And that would keep things in peace. Now, the only part of the country that didn't get this that got invaded was what? The South. An evil place, no doubt. You know, it's that's the American image. The South is evil. And I admit, I still have that feeling when I go down there. I'm really surprised to see so many Christians. How could this be, you know? And here, I'm not even a Yankee. I'm a Westerner. When I get down there, I'm really surprised to see. Well, it's interesting, though. The odd thing is, we're down there where we really banged them around in the South. And I think we did this as much to damage the Negro as the white until about 1940... There was still severe economic discrimination against the South. Railroad rates. You could ship something from here practically to California for the same price you could ship it from, say, here to Kentucky or Tennessee. Supreme Court knocked those rates, those discriminatory rates down, I think, sometime during the Second World War. That's a long time to have that go on. Well, now, I grant you there is evil in the South. In fact, they're quite aware of it. And that may be part of the reason that Christianity, in some areas, seemed to flourish down there better than it did up here. Because there had been more suffering. This sort of unreal side of it, which led people into presumption. And what it gave... Gradually, as things became more and more secularized, the secularized YMCA became the type of the new America. That this is the new world. Athletic Christianity. And Babbitt, you get the whole story there in Babbitt's conversion. Sinclair Lewis, you know. Conversion basically is conformity to a nice society. It's the sinner putting away the obvious sin. But it's not real repentance. And it's really this that H.L. Mencken, in his penetrating way, is writing about in his little essay. I think it's just called Puritanism. And in it, I was paraphrasing him, and he said a Puritan is someone who's secretly afraid that someone somewhere is happy. Now, he didn't mean Puritan. What he meant was the sort of the secularized Puritan, the Methodist without his piety. This was really what he had in mind, or the Presbyterian without his piety. Now, this is complicated in America, and I'm not going to just throw a lot of this at you, but you, in case you want to do any further research in the American scene... There's a complication here in that American history, a lot of what we're talking about goes back into English antecedents. I've not said much about France. But what you need to understand is that the French Revolution began to penetrate this country, and the French Revolution went through a series of phases. You know, it didn't start in 1788-79. It rather started... with 1760, phase one. Phase one was the French intellectuals and men like Condorcet. Condillac. And of course, Diderot and others. Well, the writing of these French revolutionaries came here. Let's see, the first phase from them was, say, 70, we'd say 88, 89. Then you had the revolutionary phase and developing into the terror, which would be sort of, this would be stage one. Then the terror would be stage two. And stage three would be the reaction, right? Still revolution, though. It goes imperial under Napoleon. And then a fourth stage is socialist. See, there's one way of reading history. It's simply it's French history and American. With German, with Russian history coming out of this, the commune of the 1870s. Well, if you see this then, when did this influence begin to hit the U.S.? Very early. It came around 1790 and right after. These works were being translated rapidly and even being published in this country. And they were associated with deism and so on. But they had one overarching theme which seems to me to fit in with this practical secularism of American life. And that theme was progress, which is virtually automatic. In fact, if you want to read something about it, of course, you could always get Burry's, B-U-R-Y's, book, The Idea of Progress. But here is a refinement on that. It's a fascinating book, The Idea of Progress in the United States, 1815 to 1860. Now, when you see that how influential it was, what was behind this? Well, essentially, this was godless, out-and-out godless, and it usually got refined or transformed somewhat in the American setting, but it brought a great deal of skepticism into the United States and faith in history, that history was salvation, that the processes of history were going to issue in some kind of dawning. Now, this tended to blend with Puritan post-millennialism. And the result was these things fused back and forth. And Americans had all kinds of crazy schemes for, and Englishmen and Frenchmen and all the rest were coming over here with these schemes because they thought this was the place of the dawning. And it ranged all the way from Orthodox Christians to nutty nuts out here on the end. You know, some really weird people came over here. And we don't need to go into the history of all of this. I spent a long time looking into it. If you want to get a book, though, which was quite illuminating, you might get John Humphrey Noyes' The History of Socialisms. And I just saw not so long ago, it's in paperback of all things. I think I myself had read his original copy. It was a very dusty old volume. But it's The History of Socialisms, and it tells you the story of the sort of utopian colonies that sprang out of this and this. Now, really, in the religious sense, this became Unitarianism. And these two came together very much so, these two. Now, let me put it to you another way. Let me put it to you in terms of theology. And this comes very close to our own life, what you trust in. The Puritans, Presbyterians, and the rest were Trinitarians. And the essence of the Trinitarian faith, at least in terms of its practical cutting edge, that practical essence was that God had become man. God had come in the flesh. And that was the center of faith. It wasn't simply that there was a nice providence over everything, but that God had come with a particular wonder, and that wonder was Jesus Christ. And that was the secret of the ineffable sweetness which Edwards experienced, that he believed, he knew. And that's why these men were fearless. Now, what happened is that in American culture, many of the forms of that were carried over, but with a great reversal. And the reversal comes into very concrete expression if we just take the statement and reverse it. Not God had become man, but now, what? Man becomes God, or is potentially so. Now, I don't want to carry you too deep into this, but let me just show you how this begins to penetrate American culture. It's pretty potent. You see, revivals keep coming and going and holding this back, but it's 1830, 1850. You get a big turning in American culture, and the conflict is on. You have a young man named Charles Hodge just come on the scene, and he even writes against some of these things. In fact, Ekirch discusses Charles Hodge and his particular contribution to this conflict. Anyway, about this time, what do you get? Well, you get, during this period, you get Ralph Waldo Emerson, his Harvard Divinity School address, which says, practically in words, what I have just said to you, that man can become God. Now, it's interesting, he uses the Puritan language of man seeing. And you, for a moment, think you're listening to Puritans, this vision which had captured them, this faith which was so exciting. You suddenly have it with this terrible reversal, and it makes, for a Christian, of course, it has the phoniest ring possible. But it sounds seductive. Trust yourself. Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. Well, he's right. Every carnal heart vibrates to the idea, trust yourself. And that was Emerson in his essay, Self-Reliance. Well, here in Mormonism, this is the period from which Mormonism begins to sprout. You have the Millerites, and out of that comes Mormonism. Now, we can't blame the Millerites, no relation, for everything in Mormonism. But Mormonism has this central thesis. It's one promise. You reduce it to one thing. You too can become God. And behind, even more basic than the security which the system offers you of a material sort, is this promise that you too can become God. So here then is the great cultural watershed. And the revival of 1858, 59, 60, and so on, threw back a lot of this. And I'm persuaded the preaching of Dwight L. Moody and a number of others had the same effect. But nonetheless, this was an ongoing apostasy of a people in which they were presuming. They were taking the ark into battle. And I'm persuaded also this led to certain things, such as the Mexican-American War, in the 1840s, the Spanish-American War at the close of the century, in which it was a farce. These were exploitations by the American nation, at least a party of the American nation, over against a weaker foe. And myself, I think that was wicked. Now, when we see this, now I want to make this come to a summary. What we've now seen is unique American blessings and unique American sins. And if you're going to live and work in America, you've got both the blessings and the curses. And that's why I had you read tonight Jeremiah 17. I'm going to promise you, if you read those readings and meditate on them, you're going to be able to break out of some American sins. I didn't sit down and put those readings down in 5 minutes. This syllabus is well worked out. It's planned to give you an exposure that can really help you break off some patterns. If you even just read those verses, you'll get some help. But if you memorize them, you'll find them standing up there like a great shield protecting you from the things that are built into our society. Now, what I want to say then is this, that the great American presumption is to make faith a commodity. Religion is not only something you can market, but you can put your faith in faith. Melville spotted it, 1850. The confidence man. That's the whole point of the book. Faith in faith. Julie Andrews tells you about it too. Remember? The salesman who travels on a smile, a shoe shine. Now, what's wrong with it isn't the persuasion, but the presumption. It's the attempt to manipulate God. And you can trace this right through every part of American life, the scientific, the medical. You can trace it especially through the church, where it substitutes other things for faith, moralism, clubism, ritualism, churchism, whatever it is, you know, all kinds of things. And but the whole thing, or youth. Youth itself becomes the object of faith. And then that idol of presumption, in which faith becomes a commodity, right with it is a tremendous self-righteousness. Americans are a very proud people. Americans are the best people in the world. As far as I'm concerned, they're more open-hearted, more generous, more free with their money. But also, they're more self-righteous. And that means they're defensive, judgmental, and they're also probably more bitter than other people. And that leads to another conclusion. They're also more violent. More violent. Because they're bitter, they're more violent. Because they're bitter, they're more self-righteous behind it. And it's because they presume that or they fall into the other things. And so what I want to really lay open to you then is the simplicity of the way of escape from this pattern of idols. The simplicity lies in this. That you've got to recognize that having been brought up in America, if you're like me, you've got all kinds of presumption in you. And this is your most serious problem. I don't think I ever met an American that seemed to be, to me, immune to it. Now, among my ancestors, where I grew up at home, it was just rife with it. You know? They really did. They thought an American could defeat any other 10 people. It was amazing. But it doesn't need to take that crude form. It just means it also manifests itself in a deep unthankfulness. If you wonder if you've got it, ask yourself how thankful you are, how reverent you are. Of course, you see, all of this is irreverent, profoundly so. But the solution, what I'm saying, is very simple, to return, really, to where Edwards was. The sovereignty of God. Right? That's where we began. Return to God and His sovereignty. And notice what a gentle man he was. That blows my mind. He's famous, you know, for sinners in the hands of an angry God. But he was a very gentle person. He was quiet. And there was this inner quietness about him that made him be authentic when Thoreau and Whitman and Emerson only pretended to be authentic. He knew who he was because he knew who God was. And what this liberated him for was for a life not simply of do-goodism, but of genuine doing good, of real love to his neighbors. not an introverted quietism, but really an outreach in a thousand ways. For instance, consider his boldness after he finally was put out of his church. Here he is, what, almost 50? He goes out as a missionary to the Indians. Does he know any Indian language? He doesn't know any Indian language. Is he trained to be a missionary? No, he's not trained to be a missionary. There's no thing about being a missionary. But he's a good missionary. In my own denomination, the descendants of the converts of that still have a church, right? Stockbridge, Wisconsin. He went to the Stockbridge Indians. He was successful, really in a good way. So what I want you to get you to see then, and we can see more of this as we go to Jeremiah 17, is that the blessing of God is most readily obtained simply by switching from presumption to faith. Now, let me just say a little bit about the devil in that. In presumption, one of the marks of it is always blindness. Isn't it true? When you fall on your face in some experience, it really, you get up and here you are, you're trying to see through all the mud and so on, and you can hardly get yourself straight. And you wonder how blind you could have been. You find that you weren't thinking very much of Jesus Christ, you're thinking of yourself. And what you discover as Jesus deals with your heart, that your pride had been used by the devil to put a kind of a screen over your heart. And so after you were picked up by the Lord, you begin to see how blind you were. That you were living a hasty, nervous life, or whatever you kind of life you live. Maybe yours is a sluggish, slow one that never moves, whatever your thing is. But whatever it is, you see, the devil is able to blind you. And let me assure you, presumption is dangerous stuff. You can't resist the devil when you're walking in presumption. You have no more strength than a little kitten one day old over against my finger. You just don't. And that's the point of Israel. They had no strength. It's like this, that the devil can't touch you if you walk in faith, because that puts you under the umbrella of Christ. But if you walk in presumption, he can blind you. He can do anything he wants to you because you're standing away from Christ. But once you humble yourself by faith, he really can't touch you, because the devil is not a creator. He doesn't make anything new. He's got to work with some kind of handle inside of us. And once you pull off the handles, or the spirit breaks off the handles of bitterness or pride or whatever it may be, the devil's got no more room in you. And so really what I'm trying to say then is, culturally, as we live in the 20th century, you've really got it made. Here is a world trapped in all these things: presumption, self-righteousness, violence, and bitterness. They say there's no answer. But you know absolutely there is. You've got it in Jesus Christ. And you're extremely important then. And of course the devil wants to get you and lift you up in pride, because you're a tremendous threat to his whole kingdom. He hates to see you humbled. He hates to see you believing. He hates to see you praising God. And so what I'd suggest tonight is that we dedicate ourselves to making the devil extremely unhappy. How about that? How about making the devil really miserable tonight by rejoicing in what God has given you in Christ?